Is that you?
Good morning and welcome to Dateline New Haven. I'm your host, Paul Bass, inviting you to look behind the headlines on the stories that make New Haven tick. Nothing ticks better than Pundit Friday, which we're about to begin here in the WNHH studio with the number one pundits in the media universe. Pundits like the Valor... Pundits like the valorous and validating voice of vibification that vanquishes all vanity and vacillation. The pastor of parking ticket palpitation. The dairy-free goddess of our grassroots radio operation. The bell of our ball. Managing editor of the Inner City News and host of WNHH's Love Babs program, Babs Rawls Ivy.
Good morning.
Like the illustrious incubator of insight and incision. The flyest news hunter gatherer this side of Fleet Street, boss of the budget beaten beauty beat star New Haven reporter, independent reporter Markeisha Ricks.
Yeah, Markeisha.
That's new.
Yeah.
The Fancy. Prescient and piquant purveyor of passion. The queen of quippery and quintessence of compassion, Lavoz Hispana, publisher Norma Rodriguez Reyes.
She's going to do a whole show in Ignite.
And WNHA station manager and heavy D Trump devotee, Harry Droz.
Yes,
the bravest Harry. Man in New Haven. Welcome, everybody. Joe Ugly is another guy who has a bunch of epithets to his name, but he is not. He's away for 2 weeks on vacation in Germany. So he's representing us abroad.
That's how the 2% live.
While the 99% are here in the studio talking about the news, which there was a lot of news in New Haven this week, folks. But Norma, you were down in Puerto Rico.
I sure was. Yeah.
And why don't you come by the microphone so we can hear you,
Norma. You know how to do this.
So, Norma, you were in Puerto Rico, you were having some fun, but did you also vote? There was an election in Puerto Rico when
you were down there. That's right. I think this is the seventh or the ninth election for plebiscite that the residents of Puerto Rico go to the polls every three or four years to decide whether the island of Puerto Rico is going to stay as it is, status quo, if it's going to become the 51st state, or if it's going to be independent.
Meaning that it wouldn't be part of the United States.
Right.
It'd be its own nation.
It would be a republic.
Uh-huh. Could you get real close to the mic, Norma?
Oh, yeah. It would be a republic. So basically independent, able to trade with everybody else. But I don't think the United States would let it do it because it has too much invested
right
in the island.
Right now, it's a colony of the United States.
That's right. But they don't say that it's a colony, right?
What do they say?
Commonwealth.
Commonwealth.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So, Norma, when these elections take place, they don't have any legal binding, right? So they don't, just if they vote, that doesn't mean it happens, right?
That's exactly one of the reasons why the PPD, Partido Progresista Democrata, Partido Popular, which is considered like the Democratic end of the party, all of them refused to vote. They did not vote at all.
Why?
So if you because they don't want Puerto Rico to become a state. The people who, the governor, he stands for the PNP, that he's in that party. He's the one that is interested. It's that party that wants it to become a 51 state.
Now, what's the reason some people feel they want it to become a state?
Because they first of all, the Puerto Ricans in the island are not allowed to vote for the president of the United States.
Really?
No. Yep. They can't.
I know they don't vote for, they don't get their own senators. Yep. They don't get their own Congress people. But they don't. So Harry, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they don't get to vote for the presidency.
No,
so, but even still, for the Democratic Party, they do send their own delegates, even though they don't get to.
Right.
So it's like DC.
They
have a voice, but they don't have a vote.
Yeah, that's weird.
Right. They have a voice and they don't have a vote. And it's true, they do participate in the primary process and they calculate the votes, but it doesn't really mean anything. It's very similar to Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. They didn't have the right to vote either. It wasn't.
And they still don't have. They only have an observer in the Congress. They don't have their own Congressman.
And I remember when I was in the League of Women Voter Convention last year, that's one of the things that the League of Women Voters want to accomplish. They are supporting that the people from the District of Columbia be allowed to vote for the president of the United States, and that it's counted.
And there are people in D.C. who want statehood.
And I, for instance, I
don't see how you can argue against statehood for D.C. I mean, Harry, you'd be the only person here who might, right? What would be the reason not to have statehood in D.C.?
For D.C.? I wouldn't see any reason. Just like I wouldn't see any reason for Puerto Rico, especially you know, what the United States and Europe, the Europeans, have put Puerto Rico through. So, and I know the reason people want to vote, you know, want statehood now for Puerto Rico, because they've been against it for so long. And now they're just hoping that the United States swallows the debt.
Right, because Puerto Rico going bankrupt.
State, yes.
So now, Norma, did you vote in this election?
No.
Come on, you didn't do a New Haven? You didn't cast your vote?
No, I have to be registered to vote over there.
Legally
and I'm
you
like, my only registered to vote in New Haven, Connecticut.
What do you mean? You have to register.
And now
don't
it,
you just have to be Puerto Rican?
Talking about voting, you know, a lot of people don't understand the ramifications if you vote. And if you if you're not registered to vote, and if you illegally take and you vote, you know, that's very serious.
The and that's why the consequences doesn't happen very often.
Yeah.
It's so, Norma, there was this plebiscite. It was an overwhelming vote in favor of statehood, correct?
No. It's really, if you do the numbers.
What was the result?
If you do the numbers and you calculate the number of people that did not vote.
No, I understand that. I was going to get to that. Oh. But the result of the election was a landslide for statehood, but everybody who was against statehood did not vote.
Right.
And in the end, it has no bearing. It's just expressing some will. But let me ask you this, and tell me if I'm wrong about this, Harry. I think you and Norma, your families, your parents both came to the U.S. from Puerto Rico.
Yes.
And that until recently, the Latino community in New Haven was primarily Puerto Rican. Now it's from all over Latin America. How would you two have voted in this plebiscite? Because the options on the table were status quo, it's a colony, become a state, or secede. You know, they're doing this in Scotland and other places. Whether you secede
from
these empires.
The secession part doesn't make sense, right? The Puerto Ricans would give up their citizenship in the United States. That would be insane.
Well, they have their own country.
And it would be insane to give up the citizenship.
Because you think it wouldn't be a viable enough economy?
It wouldn't be a viable economy. They'd still be in debt. And you give up all your privilege of being an American. Insane.
And contracts, government aid. But what about the other two questions, statehood or status quo?
Well, statehood, yes. I've been wanting Puerto Rico to become a state. But the problem is that it's hard because the people financially aren't ready to become a state, to go through what normal states go through and actually have to pay in.
Don't they pay income tax? Are they not paying income tax?
Puerto Ricans pay more than income tax. Because I just went over there. They have three different types of taxes that they're charging you.
Mm.
See, I love when Norma gets mad. She's mad. Someone has to pay taxes.
So, I mean, I think I was a little kid when Alaska and Hawaii came on board. So, like, what was anybody alive and what was the difference in terms of what their finances looked like? So
one of the reasons why I am not in favor of statehood is because of what happened to the people of Hawaii when they became a state. Prior to Hawaiian becoming a state, a lot of Hawaiians owned their own land,
mm-hmm.
and they had their own culture and they had everything. But then as soon as it became a state, they lost all their land because now they come in, they survey the land, they charge all these taxes. So the farmers lost the Hawaiian farmers lost everything.
Mm-hmm.
And now very few Hawaiians own their own land.
That was 1959.
Right. Yes, okay.
I was not alive.
And that's what I mean. The people themselves aren't ready for statehood. There has to be a way. I don't want to sound like a liberal. But there has to be.
Because that would be the worst thing ever, right?
That would be the
worst. It's so interesting, Harry, because this really doesn't seem to me so liberal and conservative.
Yeah, yeah.
This really seems to be one of those wonderful questions that don't have to do with whether you're a liberal or conservative. It's like, what's the best way for people to be represented?
Actually, yes. And also...
And Alaska was also 1959, by the way.
Well, I also think
it's... Definitely not.
It's sort of a reparation in a form because...
Like, how do you compensate people if you're going to change? Like, if they're going to lose their land,
exactly.
How do you compensate them? But Alaska seemed to have a sweet deal with all of the oil and stuff because people who move to Alaska make money.
Yeah. I don't get why U.S. should be an empire. Why should we control Puerto Rico? Why should we control Hawaii? These places aren't even contiguous to the United States.
But you know what?
You're thinking colonialism.
Yeah, it is colonialism.
This isn't...
Are they thinking national defense?
They made us citizen in 1917.
Strategically, Puerto Rico is in the optimal position. And I say we, as a Puerto Rican, we should get something out of that. You know? And... this is the thing that it gets really hard, because I talk in a reparation way, but I don't believe in an entire reparation. But Puerto Rico has been stripped of everything. Has been stripped of everything. There's a reason it's called Puerto Rico. It's a rich port. Okay.
And it's bankrupt.
Statehood
hasn't been great for it then.
Because it seems to have all the benefits without the actual
lack
title.
Of statehood, yeah.
It's a double-edged sword.
And do you feel like the current folks in leadership, if Puerto Rico were to go down the statehood route, wouldn't just say, we're going to wipe out this debt, but you get to be a state. Congratulations.
That's the wishful thinking of the people who voted to be, you know, a state, but that's,
I don't think that's wishful thinking, because if I were voting to be a state, I would, yes, I would also want you to wipe out my debt, but I'd also not want you to steal my land.
But you know, the American mainland will not allow Puerto Rico, even no matter how many votes we cast, to become a state, because first of all, you cannot add more congressmen and more senators. So therefore, based on the Constitution,
No.
You cannot add more.
You can. The Republicans might not let it become a state, because Puerto Rico would be
Democratic.
Right. Two more congressmen, you know, Democrats, congressmen.
That's not true. Because first of all, in Puerto Rico, there's just as many Republicans as there are Democrats.
The truth
is, 50-50.
The Republicans would have to, instead of trying to win those votes, which they could do through culturally conservative issues, the Republicans, like the Democrats, would rather use their power to protect the power they have now, rather than have to have a more democratic society where they go win the votes by making a better argument.
Look at the hedge funds that debt that Puerto Rico has. They don't want to restructure it. They just want to keep strangling the island. And what's happening is, I really believe that they're doing displacement of people, which in a way, I'm kind of happy that the Puerto Rico is going through the financial crisis that it's going through, because what's happening is now in Puerto Rico, 95%, a large percentage, graduate from the universities. So now what's happening is they're being forced to come in to the mainland, either to the south, and thank goodness a lot of them are now coming to the north, because otherwise, it's true what Paul said, we were becoming the minority of the Latinos, within the minority.
Interesting.
But now with all these Puerto Ricans coming in, and they're all educated, and a lot of them, the ones that come from the city, they speak English just as well as we do.
And the state, I mean, our city is about to make a play for Puerto Rican educators.
Marquisha just figured out why I brought up the subject. First, I'm going to remind people that they listen to Pundit Friday.
My bad, I forgot that part. I got excited.
103.5 FM, live streamed at newhavenindependent.org. It's your good, not your bad, Marquisha. Thank you for that
transition. I got excited. I forgot the segue part.
You got the segue. Thank you, Marquisha. So, Norman, when you were down in Puerto Rico, did you happen to notice any poachers or spies from the New Haven Board of Education?
I know.
Do they have on t-shirts?
They went over there for a whole week and interviewed
a whole bunch of people from New Haven.
No, they interviewed one of the individuals that went over there to interview, because they had 45 interviews set. Every hour on the hour, they were interviewing for those days that they were there.
Well, tell us who they are and what they're interviewing for.
These are educators. I guess they're directors of the bilingual program, because there's a serious lack of bilingual teachers here in the mainland. And so they went to Puerto Rico, and they were very surprised, because they had previously in the 80s gone to Puerto Rico and brought teachers. And at that time, they really weren't bicultural or bilingual, for that matter. They were more monolingual than bilingual. Mm-hmm. But at that time, they needed them, so they used whatever they had. Now those teachers are all very bilingual, to a point that they speak English with hardly any accent at all.
Wow.
So that's like really
surprising. So let's tell
people
what's going on. There is a race going on among poachers in Puerto Rico. While their government's falling apart and the school system's falling apart and underfunded, and their pensions are in trouble. It's called a Ponzi scheme, or the pensions legalized Ponzi scheme, which actually is going to happen in other states too, because apparently a lot of pension funds are tied up with hedge funds that have been taking big fees out, but actually getting terrible returns. But in any case, that's a side bite. So Puerto Rico's falling apart. So all these cities, not just New Haven, Dallas, Houston, Las Vegas is Clark County, Oklahoma City, Buffalo, they're all sending down people because they have this problem, which is that we need bilingual teachers and they cost more, right? So New Haven, the Board of Ed has a budget crisis. The state pulled millions of dollars, some of it right in the middle of the year that was already approved. They've been scrambling at the Board of Ed how to make millions of dollars up, that they, some of which they already told they were getting. At the same time, they have to hire 95 teachers, and a lot of them, some of them are bilingual teachers who cost more. But if they're desperate in Puerto Rico, they might not cost more. So as Norma said, these might be some of the best.
So it doesn't matter if they are picking sugar cane or teaching, they're going to get exploited.
Now, not exploited, because I would argue, Babs, that you get paid well as a teacher and you get good benefits. But what bilingual teachers got because of their market position was they got more than other teachers. So now all he said, he's saying, hey, we can pay them the regular price and not the extra price. We'll take advantage of their misery. So they're all...
And how is that not exploitation? That's what exploitation is. Yeah,
I would argue that if in the end...
Because they're living a little better.
No, they're it's exploitation of an opportunity and someone else's misery, but it's not bringing them here to be in non-union jobs. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a pretty sweet... My daughter is a school teacher, which makes me so happy, not only because I love that she teaches school, but she's got like a pension. She makes more money at 27 than I have in my life, pretty much, pretty close. She has health benefits. So she gets paid decently, not tons, but she gets paid really decently for doing important work. But in any case, that's aside. So in any case, New Haven sent three staffers down there, recruiters to Puerto Rico. They heard Norma Rodriguez Reyes was going. They said, we got to follow. This is our opportunity. And as Norma said, they're closing 184 schools in Puerto Rico. A lot of people are going to be out of jobs. So, in fact, it is kind of good if they show them a new opportunity, right?
How are they going to, how does that work? How do you
close? Because you're going to go from having, this educated population and all these talented people, and you're going to close 148 schools, and you're going to go back to not necessarily having that. That seems like a bad investment on America's part.
So, 200 people in Puerto Rico applied for these bilingual slots. And I'll say that, yeah, Babs is right. We're taking advantage of an opportunity or exploiting it. But in the realm of exploitation, like the whole sugar industry where people are basically slaves, if someone's losing their job in Puerto Rico and the schools are closing, I'm kind of glad they get an opportunity to help us out with something too, and they get a pretty decent pay. And
because that's how white people think like
that. So tell me how black person sees it. Tell me how
black. Either way, this all sounds like.
All right, tell me more about that, Babs. This is great.
Because it's just this mindset. Well, see, look, this will be better in the long run for you without even thinking about.
And it's better for them, better for Puerto Rico.
Right.
It's not better. It might be a little better, but it's not better because in a better world, if this is happening.
They would be able to be in Puerto Rico teaching and doing what
exactly,
they do.
That would be an option. And if they wanted to come and teach on the mainland. They'd be paid a premium for their skills. I think the biggest thing that I think is so messed up is that people come to our country and have these extra skills and they don't actually get paid for them. If you're an American who can speak another language, and of course, if you're Puerto Rican, you're American, so you can speak Spanish. But if you are just a regular old Joe American who happens to go learn another language, you can get paid so much more money because of your language skills. But if you're somebody who if that's your native language, you might not get paid for it. People in our business, I don't think Latino reporters get paid more because they speak Spanish. But the company's taking advantage of what they can do, but they don't pay them any extra money for that.
So the way you're schooling me here is, the way we're doing from a black person, white person, this is great, is that the best solution would be if the people in Puerto Rico got more freedom of choice. That instead of the United States taking advantage, the mainland, of a crisis in a colony that is operating without rights in the United States Empire, that instead of us taking advantage of a bad economy there where people have fewer options and bringing them here for our own benefit, we should stop exploiting Puerto Rico, enable it to thrive so that people there can decide on their own. We can make a living where we want to live and have good schools. Or if we then choose to come to the mainland, we will have more bargaining power and get paid that premium for what we're doing. Are you guys telling me?
Yes. We do that with wars. When we fight wars and we win, or what we considered winning, we go in and buff up infrastructure.
That was the Marshall Plan. I don't know if we still do that.
We do. Yeah. We
should, yeah.
But I think we do. I think even though we don't say we do that anymore, we still do it. We do it.
We do it
on the back end.
We build schools.
But that's after
people.
We bombed the heck out of it. I mean, look what we did to Iraq.
But that's what I mean. My point is, there is the will to do it.
Well, here's the reality. When they took over Puerto Rico, they treated us like crap. Okay? They've treated us like crap for...
Since they were landed.
I mean, let's just not just start with the United States. But Puerto Rico's been exploited by the Europeans forever. You know? And everybody, it's like Puerto Rico's a lost story. You know, Puerto Rico's been through so much and nobody cares. And it's like now they look at Puerto Rico like if they have a handout.
Yeah.
But it's also the same story though, right? So Puerto Rico's in all this trouble and we're closing schools. We're going to exploit the fact that we're closing schools by taking advantage of all these teachers who are going to need jobs. What investments are we putting into Puerto Rico? Like what? Like we're still underdeveloping Puerto Rico or making sure that it's always like it's never going to recover from all the exploitation because we're constantly taking. We're not giving anything back.
And when we talk about exploitation, let's not forget the scientific exploitation of those people of
birth control
and all other kinds of experiments that they've done. In Vieques and all these other places.
Is the Native American story. Okay? When the Europeans landed there, they slaughtered Puerto Ricans, killed our men, and then they had African slaves. That this is why Puerto Rico goes from white to black Puerto Ricans, because we're mixed with Europeans, African slaves, Indians. You know, so that's the story of Puerto Rico that nobody tells. It's like, I'm telling you, it's like.
Did someone slip Harry an anti-Trump pill on his head?
No, he got all Puerto Rican. But you know, he's like, I'm ready for this.
No, you okay, man? Harry?
No, but you know,
he's like, y'all gonna get this Puerto Rican story today.
There was
a professor.
I love it. It's good.
A professor in Stanford University that did research, okay, on DNAs, and it was published. I think it was last year, or the year before last. Okay, that the Puerto Ricans have the perfect DNA. And it has to do with the percentage of white that we have from the Europeans, the percentage of the blacks, because we have Africans from Africa, not from other places. They came from Africa because there's still sections in Puerto Rico that, and that's why you'll see somebody blue-black and doesn't speak a word of English. And at one time, you know, people were really fascinated with that because, you know, and then you have the Indians and the Chinese when they came to build the railroads. Because some Puerto Ricans, we call them Chino. And it's because they have this the Chinese look. And it was because a lot of Chinese, when they came to build the railroad, they stayed there. But you know what? In the 1920s or 30s, they took 5,000 Puerto Ricans and they shipped them to Hawaii to do the farms. Yeah. And the coqui, which is the little frog, that's like the mascot of Puerto Rico. The only other place that it has been able to survive is in Hawaii. And yet, you know that they exterminate them because of the sound that they make, the coqui noise at nighttime. The people from Hawaii can't take it. So they exterminate them. In Puerto Rico, if you even think about killing one of them, it's like, oh my, it's like doing the eagle of the United States. It's like messing with the eagle of the United States.
All right.
And
well,
you know what? And wait, and that's an important story that she talked about. Puerto Ricans going to Hawaii because I have a friend who is a writer who is writing a book on this. Maricel Vera is writing a book on how Puerto Ricans were and they purposely chose Puerto Ricans because they thought that their sensitivity to the climate would lend themselves to being workers in Hawaii. So that's a pretty important piece to talk about.
My wife, for Christmas, I got her the DNA test. And her DNA goes from the African Congo all the way to the Indians in Peru. Okay? That's who we are. That's who we are. And everybody ignores it. You know, it's sad what they're doing to Puerto Rico right now.
All right, but it's not sad that we get to tell the truth here on Pundit Friday and WNHH Radio. You're home for community radio at 103.5 FM, live streamed to New Haven and Pendorg. We got Charles Ivy, Harry Jones, Nora Rodriguez Reyes, and Marquisa Ricks here with me. I'm your host, Paul Bass, on our weekly show, which is my favorite way to top off the week.
Thank you for the opportunity, Paul Bass.
The platform.
Thank you for the platform, Paul Beasley.
Yeah. Right. Haters go hate.
I need more pay because I'm bilingual.
So wait, are you thanking
that's
me
right.
for making
that's
a
right. business? Get that money.
Are you thanking me for making a business opportunity available for you rather than helping to nurture, as Sam Ross Lee would say, the plantation of black media, right?
Oh, is that what he says?
Remember he's mad that it's here on the white guys.
That's true. Yeah,
he's got a point.
Whatever.
Well, my point is, what happens at the Board of Ed? So think of these poor bilingual teachers. If they come here thinking everything's good, what if they show up at a Board of Education meeting?
Oh,
can you imagine how they're going to feel about the job? So this week was a typical week. A reporter, Chris Speak, just was amazed because he's new at the Independent. He's covering the schools. He was on the first meeting. He called me up. He said, I can't believe how nasty everybody was when they got up and started yelling at everybody
at the
public comment section. I felt so blessed
to be reading the story.
So he wrote a story. Just, you know, it's the kind of thing when something happens every week, you just think it's the norm, and someone new comes in and looks at it and said, I can't believe this goes on. So, of course, they had the public session where everyone gets up. You're supposed to talk for 3 minutes. Remember 3 minutes? So one of the people first to get up is always Reverend Boise Kimber, who literally goes for sometimes 30 minutes and tells them they're not allowed to stop him and they're too wimpy to stop him, right? So he's yelling at them because he's mad because they didn't let him open a charter boys school and get money out of it when he has no education background and that didn't even understand what a charter school was and there was no reason it had to be a charter school, right? So he's still mad. So he gets up, he starts insulting them, accusing them of everything. You all do nothing and your special education department sucks. Like, oh, no, somebody else. He's yelling, talking, telling them they're corrupt, calling for, like, investigations into them, reading them articles from Bridgeport about how they should have still supported school, which is now a dead issue. And he goes on and on. They tell him he's out of order because he's talking way past time. He says, no, y'all out of order. And then somebody else stands up and says, y'all
this
do
whole
nothing.
Room's out of order.
And then somebody else says, your special education department sucks. You guys are not doing the right things. I'm beyond
you're out of
off.
Order. You're out of order.
So everyone's standing up telling them they're corrupt, dumb, and worst of all, they call them politicians. And like, I think we all in this room would say it's so important the public get to address the board and tell them, you know, when they think they're wrong and bring problems to light. But this has been out of hand for a long time.
For years. It's been out of control.
So, you know what? Here's a fundraiser. Everybody put on gloves and go in the middle of the ring.
So, Babs,
we do
now,
have
Babs,
new boxing
you've
match
spent more
happening.
Time probably in this room, except for maybe Norma, sitting on boards and commissions and long, boring meetings and trying to have a civil public process when people break the rules and disrupt and try to take advantage. What would you have been like if you were in charge of the Board of Ed when this goes on? How tough would you be? What rules would you set? And how would you allow this public discussion to take place in a civil, productive way?
I think I would have to be, I'd be very hard because and then I would have to appeal to their better angels. This has been going on for a very long time. This has been a very contentious.
And it's dispiriting to people who work for this board.
It's been a very contentious board from, and
but
you know,
even before it was elected.
This isn't even the board. This is the public.
This
that
is
comes
the,
up
in the and public. And I think you know what? I think if people felt like they could go to the schools where they're having the problems with and have honest goodness dialogue with the communities, with schools within the communities that they are having trouble with. I think it would cut down on people showing up to the Board of Ed. I think what happens is people...
Well, I'm glad they show up. It's how they behave when they're there.
Well, because I think the level of frustration is high.
So, Babs, once again, you're really pointing out a root of the problem that I think I wasn't paying attention to. I think you're right. I think a lot of times people feel like the individual schools, like some they think are great and really responsive. I know when you go to Common Ground with charter school, you feel you can really talk to people what's going on there and deal with issues. I mean, we want people going to the Board of Ed, but you're right that maybe part of this frustration, I don't think that explains Reverend Kimber.
And I think it doesn't explain. There are like two different groups of people who kind of show up.
But Pam's got a really good point.
She does have a really good point because it reminds me of there was a woman, I can't recall her name at the time, but I know the few times that I was covering the Board of Education, there was a woman who had been working for, I think, 2 years to get like a better policy around asthma and school nurses and that type of thing, the administering of medications and things. Like, she'd been working for 2 years and she felt like nobody was hearing her. So she kept showing up to Board of Ed meetings to see like, okay, I've tried everything else and now I have to come to you and talk. And she was never disrespectful. But I've even seen teachers come and say, like, for instance, the teachers from Creed High, who would come and say, look, we need a school leader. Like, they didn't have a principal for a minute. And they're like, we need y'all to do this. So, like, all this other noise, we need you
like
to
if they
fix
had
this
an ombudsman office so that people felt like, you know, their concerns weren't just dangling in the wind. And I think that's, and that's very frustrating, particularly when education is so tantamount to the success of your child's future. That's what we believe. We believe that. But when parents or advocates of children are stopped before they even get to the gate, it makes people frustrated. And so their only recourse is to show up at these Board of Ed meetings and just show out.
So let me ask you some forward-looking then solutions. Do we want people to be able to speak at the Board of Ed at their main meeting so that we encourage people to show up, watch the decisions being made, participate, but just much more strictly enforce the 3-minute rule and rules of civility and maybe just like sit on Reverend Kimber? Or do you want to have a special, like other boards, let's say the Board of Alders, have their public hearings in committee? So they have a main meeting where they debate, or the U.S. Congress, right? They'll bring experts to testify, whatever you try to get on there. Should there be instead a, like, Vladimir Putin does once a year with 4 hours of chosen people, he did yesterday, I think it was, where you'll get there. But should the Board of Ed instead have committee meetings where people come and raise stuff, or is that shunting them out of the spotlight? Should we still have, I think we would all agree it needs to be a better run public process. You have to enforce, just like we do in our comments section. There's certain things you can't say. You don't get to shut everybody else up and dominate it and break the rules the way Reverend Kimber does. But maybe we do want to encourage everyone to come and speak at the full meetings themselves, but just more closely. Or is it still legitimate in government to have other fora in which you can do it, like special committee meetings or not special, regular committee meetings? What do you think the solution is?
Ooh. I mean,
as someone who attends a lot of public meetings, I'm a fan of the Board of Alders, like, because you can tailor it. You can have very specific conversations, like, we're going to talk about charter schools, and specifically about Boise Kimber's charter school. And everybody who wants to come talk about that can come talk about that issue. Obviously, the Board of Ed is a lot smaller. And again, you're asking people to devote a lot of time, a lot of volunteer hours to do additional things. But they do already have other committees.
They have
in the Board of Education.
Those don't meet quite as much.
But they meet, and they meet in at like during the day, like very odd times where most people might be at work. So you're asking people to commit to meeting at times that are more convenient for the public. So it's a lot of work.
I think it's 5:30, but it's like finance and administration.
I think they have some meetings at 2 sometimes. Okay. And so
Marquise, it sounds to me like you're proposing to do what the Board of Alders does, which have committee meetings about specific topics, and everyone who cares about that topic can come speak.
And people can like submit their topic at the regular public meeting. They wouldn't get to speak on it, but because here's the thing for me about the public meeting: A, you're there to conduct certain business, right? Like you have to actually get some things done. You have to vote about personnel matters and things of that nature. Also, it's not a back and forth process, right? So the people are just blasting the board. And I think that's fine. Fine. If you want to blast those guys, you can do that at a different forum and not to create a situation where they get to blast you back. But y'all have to have a dialogue, like they can ask questions. They can dig a little deeper, like what's behind this issue. Sometimes people are just taking notes. I think sometimes people are just rolling their eyes. I'm like, oh, my God, not again.
And it's hard.
Like
in public.
After a while, you can't hear it when all the time. And then there are people at the, like with the whole Garth Harris firing, there were people who had a legitimate agenda. They were like, my job here is to get this guy fired and I won't be back after he's fired. I don't have anything else to say after that. So
I guess the other challenge to me too is how do you moderate public debate when you have people who want to disrupt and aren't going to follow the rules?
Yeah.
Like how do you deal with Reverend Kimber?
Do you put them out? Like, I don't know. Is that too far? You say if you can't respect the rules, if you can't understand the decorum, I'm going to put you out.
Well, you got to strengthen the rules that are in place.
They've tried that.
You know, and if you have to cut
his
mic off.
That's true, they did try that, Marquise.
Tried that
right.
Too. And he just keeps talking. He's like, he said, the quote is, I'm a Baptist preacher. I don't need a mic. So, like, I hate to say it, you know, but the only way to stop somebody like that is to be like, you have to get out of my meeting.
Well, we do have 4 mics.
I'm
going
to ask the security to squirt you out.
We do have 4 mics here at Pundit Friday.
We do.
And a big platform where we talk about the week's news on WNHH Radio, your home for community radio, 103.5 FM, live stream at New Haven Independent. newhaven.org. Well, amid all the noise, there's also a lot of joy being shouted in New Haven these weeks. Summer starts, which has become, summer season's become just such a fun time.
As I wear my sweatshirt and drink hot chocolate in June.
There's so much going on in New Haven every week. Fun stuff to do. You can't even get to it all. And especially now, we're starting with the Arts and Ideas Festival. Yes. Now, you guys have already hit a couple of those, right? What have you guys hit so far?
Oh, my God. Last night, we were at Black Girl, the linguistic play.
What is that?
Camille
Brown
choreographed a play celebrating Black girlhood into womanhood, seriously. And she wasn't here for the white gaze about it either. Meaning, when white folks were talking about it, she reminded them that this was deliberately Black.
Unapologetically.
Where was
Black.
This and what was it? A dance performance?
It was a dance performance.
It's at the University Theater.
Yes.
And it was well attended. It was so packed in there. And I was very happy to see young Black and brown girls in the audience, and they got to ask some questions. And
afterwards,
because there was a talk back afterwards. And as Bab said, she described what she attempted to do on stage, using things like hand games, which are kind of universal to girls. Even though I was telling Paul earlier today, you know, when I was a kid, that wasn't limited to girls. Like, my younger male cousins jumped in and played those games. They knew all the sing-song rhymes and all of that sort of thing. And, you know, I have a special place in my heart for Double Dutch, because I'm a Black girl born in Philadelphia, not raised in Philadelphia, so I can't Double Dutch to save my life. But I always loved it. I always loved the rhythm of it and the little songs that go with it. And she captured all of that beautifully. And it's a part of Blackness, a part of Black womanness, and a part of girlness that we don't always get to see portrayed in the media and in the national discourse and images of what Black women are. There are only a few tropes that were allowed: the angry Black woman and the bad Black girl and
the strong, you know, mammy-ish
and sisterhood in terms of women and girls not being able to get along. Yeah. Right. But she covered all of that in like an hour
and hair.
And
she covered all Black hair.
She did cover Black hair. I mean,
it was
amazing.
Beautiful. So it was great.
Now you had the talk back after.
Yeah.
Now I saw Harry Droz nodding his head. Now, you're not a Black woman. You weren't a Black girl. But tell me what you were nodding your head about.
There
Harry
was something
Droz.
About Double Dutch.
Well, not just the Double Dutch, the hand games Markeisha was talking about.
And her point was that it wasn't just girls.
It's not just girls. It's part of life when you live in a minority community. It's just, we learned how to play games.
You're talking now about Bed-Stuy. You grew up in Bed-Stuy.
I'm sure it wasn't just Bed-Stuy, but
it's pretty universal.
It's pretty universal. And the reality of it is we didn't have ballparks. We didn't have, you know, the luxury that people with money had. So you had the girls out there playing Double Dutch, playing all different types of games. And the guys would go out there and play stickball, skelly, and different things. And I would jump into the Double Dutch, too. Like I was telling Babs, I used to jump in.
We were talking about it on Love Babs this morning.
I used to jump in, and for me, it was a way of getting to talk to the girls because they would want to help me.
That's like, come on, let me teach you this because you're not that good at this.
You see?
But I mean, it just brings back so many memories. Like, I can just vividly remember being on my grandmother's stoops, and the girls would be, my aunts would jump in, like, because that was their childhood. So, like, this idea of, like, you know, these women who are, like, whooping your butt all summer is like, they're going to jump in and play with you. And they're like, y'all don't know what you're doing. Let me show you this. And they'll do a little song from their childhood that you didn't know. And they've got your grandmother's clothesline, these painful ropes that if you get hit, you're gonna end up with welts. But like, these are like, it was that evocative. Yeah. Like those memories, like you can smell summer when you watch something like this, because it just brings back those kinds of memories.
But it's sad they don't have that. They hardly have that nowadays, right?
No, they do. I see girls still jumping.
Yeah, the girls in my neighborhood used to use electrical wires.
Yeah,
if you used to get hit with that.
but you know what? As you guys are talking about this, the thoughts that are coming into my mind is, I grew up in the Hill. When we first moved there, we were the only Puerto Rican family there, and then a lot of whites. But then it started becoming an African American neighborhood, and that's where then we couldn't really, because we weren't considered whites, and we definitely weren't considered Black. Mm-hmm. And in school, they used to make us put other.
Oh.
When we used to fill out any applications under white or black, we had to put other. But that being said, I remember since growing up in the African American neighborhood, the only ones that those became our friends. And so we wanted to dress and have our hair and everything like the African Americans did.
I was gonna say, did you sit on somebody's stoop and let them cornrow your hair?
And now what I find very fascinating is that now the African Americans, with all this Hispanic influence coming in, a lot of them have also chosen a lot of the Spanish influence in them. So, and it only happens here in America.
Yeah, and at the Trombone Shorty concert. Well, I was about to say conference. Concert.
That was a Coffee Music Hall last Sunday night.
Yes. That was loud.
That was amazing.
And, good.
And the band that opened for Trombone Shorty, I think is the New Breed Brass Band. I told Babs, I was like, do you feel the salsa in that? Because New Orleans is a place much like Puerto Rico where there's an intersection of those influences, yeah. Where there's European influences from the French. There's African influence from the slaves that were brought there, and there are Spanish influences because the Spanish owned Louisiana at one point. So at one point you heard like you were in a second line and then you were doing a salsa. You were like, what is this?
Yeah. it was amazing. This city is rich.
It was gumbo.
Culture.
I love it.
You know,
yeah.
I'm just loving thinking about that with all that's going on now in New Haven. Not only have the Arts Ideas with all these events where you watch something pretty high quality taking place and then talking about and thinking about how it affects your life and your community. And you have the College Street Music Hall, which is Samuel Hademan wrote this week in The Independent, is on fire.
It's such a good venue. Yeah.
You know, Yale tried to stop for 12 years us opening.
I know, it's amazing how
they didn't
want
non-Ivy League families coming to entertainment downtown. They couldn't control. And it got open. The Hart administration got around it, even though they'll never brag about it. And now you got the Schubert, which had the Motown musical this week, and the Costume Music Hall right across the street from each other in this hopping entertainment district that also has music and people living there and restaurants. You have the Taft. It's quite a success story.
There were so many people downtown last night.
Oh, yeah.
But you know what? Yes, it's quite a success story, but for the Latinos, it's not. Because if you really look at the venue, years ago, when the Arts of Ideas, they always made sure that they had on main stage a Hispanic well-known artist.
Oh, like
I feel
they do tomorrow
you.
Night.
I feel
wait,
you.
Wait, 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 wait.
I feel
tomorrow
you, too.
Night, it's a Mexican group is the
headliner. The lead concert.
The lead concert on
the
Saturday
green.
Night, the prime time of the whole week.
But I hear
wait
what she's
second,
saying.
Wait a second. I want to hear what she has to say about that.
But you know what? I don't know them. They're not known to me.
Mm.
And
but
so
wait a second. Is that fair,
to,
Norma? Is that fair? I mean, no. there might be African-American dancer wasn't known in the African-American community. There might be a Jewish musician I didn't know about. The point is that, and now you have a Mexican group you didn't know about. Arts Ideas brings them all in and we get to know them.
Because, you know, West Haven is having Julio Iglesias' son.
Right, in New Haven, we kind of we go outside the norm and the mainstream, but we
but to her point, yeah. aside from Arts and Ideas, which we know
the
brings
Schubert
in the culture,
Theater.
It's a white oriented.
The Schubert Theater, in and of itself, they don't bring Latino stuff, and they damn sure don't bring black stuff.
Well, wait, they got Motown. This
well,
week.
That's one thing out of how many things?
Again, white math.
Come on, Paul, white math. Schubert has like 100 shows and one is black. None are Latino. None are Asian. None are anything other than white. Which, okay, that's fine. It's not fine.
And it could be argued that Motown is something that white people like too. So, yeah.
Motown's success was
accessible to
Motown's
them.
Motown's success was the crossover.
Yeah.
I mean, Already knew.
And you are likely to see as many white folks in there. You know,
but to their credit, I mean, lots of white people were at the thing we went to last night, and that show wasn't about them at all.
What'd you think about Motown the musical? How was it?
I've seen it before.
I've seen it before. I mean, you know, it's the story of, you know, it's a loose story on Berry Gordy, Diana Ross, and Smokey Robinson, and what they built together that changed the sound of music and the way music was created and supported and put out that has never been done before. And it was done by black people. So
how was it? Like, I saw Dreamgirls, which was a fictionalized version inspired by...
Right, by the Motown. Supremes. It's the Diana Ross
right.
Supremes.
How does this compare
story.
With that?
Well, this is everything. This is not just...
About a group.
It's about Smokey Robinson and the music that he wrote for all these.
Oh, right. He was
artists.
A songwriter, too.
You know,
amazing
it was a piece about Marvin Gaye and Marvin Gaye's angst about, you know, where he wanted to be as an artist. He wanted to be Frank Sinatra. He wanted to cross over like that.
Sort of like Scott Joplin wanting to be a classical composer and trying to slow down ragtime.
And couldn't quite cross over, you know, into that genre. So the Motown, the musical, captures the Temptations, Diana Ross and the Supremes, and all those artists, Smokey Robinson and his influence of writing songs for everybody.
Everybody.
I mean, everybody. And the Stevie Wonder influence, and how Stevie Wonder came up in the Motown because he was a kid. He was a little kid. And how they were going to, like, ditch him because they couldn't figure out hits for him. They were like, okay, he's like a little kid. You know? Can you imagine?
He's amazing.
He turned out to be quite a
And he turned out to be, you know, this extraordinarily talented, you know, icon, right?
And he also pushed the boundaries a lot.
He did.
You know what gets me about Motown? When you go back, listen to that, right, brilliant songwriting, like Smokey Robinson, there was also something about the arrangements. Those songs were so tight.
Oh, yeah.
And they were perfect.
And they had a commitment to that.
They tell a story, and often it's sometimes a gutsy story, like Love Child or something.
Yeah.
But it's so tight and universal.
Yes.
And that kind of discipline of to do it in 2 or 3 minutes and tell a whole
story. And musicianship.
Yeah,
I mean, that speaks
and the writing.
Yes.
That is, in journalism too, that's kind of gone away a little bit. That kind of.
Yeah, that kind of writing you don't see too much.
And it still, and it lasts. When we listen to it today, it's fresh.
Yeah.
And it's exciting.
So.
And then I love on Love Babs, listen Monday at Motown, Monday's Loves Babs.
That's
and everything.
It.
I love how you talk about the music, when you talk about how they said nice things, God forbid, about black women back in the day. It made you feel positive.
There were real love songs to black women during the Motown.
You mean Love Lies?
Yeah, there was love.
It's a different show for a different
day. You've been schooling me all day. I appreciate it. I really love the lessons here. And thank you for joining us on Dateline New Haven. Thanks to the best pundits anywhere. And pundits who are pundits who punditize and give opinions. And they tell us what you think, and they're not ashamed of it. Babs Rawls-Ivy, Marquise Rix, Norma Rodriguez-Reyes, and Harry Gross. And a shout out in Germany.
Yes.
Joe Ugly.
I know he's
away
listening.
For 2 weeks.
How do we sound in German?
Looking forward to a safe return. You know, that's a little touchy subject for those of the brave background.
Oh, sorry.
Don't apologize. No need to apologize. We just don't like to hear it in the original German. We're hearing enough from Donald Trump. Yeah.
Oops, sorry.
Thanks for joining us today on Dateline New Haven. Thanks to the best pundits. We're going to take it out with the Afro-Semitic Experience performing I Wish I Knew How It Would Feel to Be Free from the group CD A Plea for Peace. Now, we know what it is like to be free. We just got to remember to book our flight. Book it all weekend long here and fly free with us at WNHH, New Haven's home for community radio.